Greece. The whites were, quite simply, badly outnumbered, and every year they failed to crush the rebels. Every little rebel success that helped to bleed Pretoria white worsened their position. It was hard to blame Pretoria for looking for a way out of the war that allowed them to salvage something. But Holliston, of course, didn't see it that way.
"I have two proposals," he said. "First, we double the number of German troops fighting in South Africa. We can easily spare 200,000 troops for as long as it takes to crush the blacks and bring peace to the country. Second, that we strike first and eliminate the government in Pretoria."
Hans blinked in surprise. He'd expected the proposal to double the number of troops in South Africa. It had, after all, been made before. But eliminating the South African government? It was insane. Which planner in Wevelsburg Castle had come up with the whole idea? Holliston pressed the idea as hard as he could.
"There are factions in Pretoria who will be happy to support us if we eliminate the current leadership," he said. "These are the factions who have been pressing for a more proactive solution to the problem."
Hans gritted his teeth. Holliston alone couldn't commit the Reich to a desperate gamble, but if he dragged the military along with him, it would be hard, perhaps impossible, to head the madcap scheme off at the pass. And it was madness, of that Hans was sure. The meaning of the facts and figures might be disputed, but the facts themselves could never be.
"The last time I checked," he said, allowing his voice to drip with sarcasm, "we sent our soldiers into South Africa to support the local government. Did something change while I was sleeping?"
"Of course not," Holliston said.
"Then perhaps you can explain to me," Hans pressed, "why supporting the local government requires executing its members and installing a set of puppets."
"The current government is unable to fight the war effectively," Holliston snapped.
Hans took a long breath. "Whatever we may think of the government of South Africa, the fact remains that it holds legitimacy in the eyes of the South Africans themselves," he said, coldly. "They will not take calmly to us stepping in and removing their government. I dare say, given that they are of good racial stock, that they will not accept whatever government we install in its place. We will be forced to occupy South Africa ourselves, to disarm the local military and fight a multi-sided war against two sets of insurgents. Furthermore, our logistics are already problematic," he added. "Our supply lines from the Reich to Germany South are poor, and the road and rail links between Germany South and South Africa are worse, even without the insurgents taking potshots at our convoys. We could drive the attackers away from the roads if we didn't have to humor the local government," Holliston hissed. "And we would find it hard to make use of the local logistics network," Hans added relentlessly.
The South Africans, damn them, had chosen to license American or British weapons rather than German, a decision that had come back to haunt them when the war began in earnest.
Indeed, the white flight from South Africa will only get worse as the war spreads into formerly safe areas. Or have you not realized just how dependent South Africa is on black labor?"
He allowed his voice to rise.
"They use black labor everywhere, even in the military," he reminded the table. "What happens if, when, those blacks become convinced that they're ultimately doomed to go into the gas chambers anyway?"
"They're of inferior stock," Holliston snapped.
"And if they're so inferior," Hans said, "why do you need an extra 200,000 troops to fight the war?"
He kept the smirk that threatened to appear off his face with an effort. He'd argued against becoming involved in South Africa, only to be overruled by the military and the SS. Now, the SS looked grossly incompetent, grasping at straws rather than swallowing their pride and admitting they'd made a mistake, while the military were concerned about ever-increasing casualty figures. Doubling the troops in South Africa, if they could be supported, might end the war, but it was equally possible that it would only increase the number of dead or wounded soldiers. And who knew what would happen when that little fact got out?
Holliston glared at him.
And you would propose ending the war?
I would propose that we find a way to avoid wasting blood and treasure on a petty, pointless war, Hans said. It will not be long before the chaos starts making its way up into Germany South or French North Africa.
The frogs can take care of themselves, Holliston growled.
They might have some problems, Hans observed. We place some pretty strict limits on their military, don't we?
Yes, Voss said flatly. The last thing we want is modern tank force within striking distance of Germany.
Hans nodded in agreement. The terrain between Vichy France and Berlin was not conducive to deep strikes, but giving Vichy the power to stand up for itself would have dangerous implications. France had been in the economic doldrums for decades, despite a slow and steady advance into North Africa. The French government might be more than willing to bend over and take whatever Berlin chose to dish out, but the French population loathed the Germans with a fiery passion. If the Reich ran into problems elsewhere, who knew which way the French would jump? And, to be fair, Spain and Italy didn't like the Germans much either. He cleared his throat.
The facts and figures make it clear, gentlemen, that we need to make some adjustments in our budget, he warned. We are spending more than we earn.
Then print more money, Holliston said. That's your job, isn't it?
That's what Weimar tried, Hans reminded him.
And what happened to Weimar?
Silence fell. Very few of the men in the room had been old enough to understand what was going on back when they'd been children. But they remembered how the Weimar Republic had collapsed into chaos. And yet, Hans knew that most of them didn't understand just how desperately Hitler had needed to keep adding new conquests to the Reich. It had taken years, after the end of the war, to put the Reich on a sound economic footing. Now all that hard work was being wasted.
The war in South Africa alone is costing us billions of Reichmarks, Hans said, both directly in weapons and equipment lost during the fighting, and indirectly in taking care of the wounded. The economic lifeline we've tossed to Pretoria is worse, in a way. We are simply not getting enough back from the mines in South Africa to pay for the war. But that isn't the worst of it. Our total military budget is sucking up far too much money.
We have to prepare to fight the Americans, Voss said.
He tossed a sharp look at Grossadmiral Caius Becker.
Don't we need to build more ships?
We can't afford many more ships, Hans said. A single nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, Field Marshal, costs over 10 billion Reichmarks.
Building enough to fight the Americans on even terms, which leaves the British out of the equation, will cost 200 billion Reichmarks.
The Americans seem to be able to afford it, Holliston said. Are you sure you're not mismanaging our money?
The Americans have several advantages, Hans growled.
First, they have a larger GNP than ourselves. They can afford to build more carriers, missiles, and spaceships without straining their economy. Second, they have a smaller budget for their other governmental functions. Third, their weapons production is standardized, not just between the different services, but also between their allies. A British soldier can fire American bullets from his gun and vice versa. Fourth, and perhaps the most important at the moment, the Americans offer much less social benefits than ourselves.
A mother's benefit packet is less than 100 Reichmarks per week, Holliston said, tightly.
The SS had been a big supporter of the scheme, although Holliston had been a lowly trooper at the time.
It is hardly a problem.
It mounts up, Hans said. There are roughly 1.5 million mothers in Berlin today. If each of them has 2 children, they can claim 160 Reichmarks each week from the government, and, I assure you, almost every mother in Berlin does. That means each week we spend somewhere around 240 million Reichmarks in Berlin alone.
He looked around the table, willing them to understand.
That's a very rough figure, he said. Right now, the average family size is 4 children, 6 in Germany East, despite the endless insurgency. Every single one of those mothers can claim 80 Reichmarks per child per week. The cost is
staggeringly high, and we can't afford it.
We need it, Holliston said, into the silence.
The folk must not be allowed to vanish from the earth.
The folk are in no danger of fading away, Hans said.
Indeed, our population is expanding rapidly. But every year we delay in dealing with this crisis, the worse it will be when it finally explodes. I can paper over the cracks for a while, but not for very long. Creative accounting will catch up with us sooner or later.
He cursed under his breath. Holliston wouldn't understand, of course. The SS was obsessed with children, to the point where it encouraged fine young German men to marry more than one wife. Hell, it had been Himmler himself who had started the original scheme. He'd noted, correctly, that cost was a major factor in bringing up children and come up with a simple idea to reduce the costs. But, like all such schemes, it had snowballed out of control and turned into a nightmare.
"We cannot make cuts," Holliston said.
"We must," Hans said. "Ending the war in South Africa alone would save a few billion Reichmarks per year."
"We could sell more weapons," Voss suggested.
"The world's buyers prefer British or American weapons," Luther Stresemann said.
The head of the Economic Intelligence Service looked concerned.
"Our reputation for producing weapons took a pounding when the Royal Navy sank the Argentinian ships during the war."
"The brown-skinned grafters didn't know how to use them," Holliston snapped.
"It doesn't matter," Hans said. Oddly, it was one of the few points where he found himself in agreement with Holliston.
"All that matters is that sales of weapons are falling and unlikely to stabilize anytime soon. The only people who buy exclusively from us are our captive markets, and we don't want to sell them the most advanced weapons."
"Of course not," Holliston said.
Hans sighed and glanced at the wall-mounted clock, silently resigning himself to another long and acrimonious meeting where nothing would be decided. If he could convince the military that eliminating Pretoria's government was a potential disaster, he told himself, at least that would be something. But, as the meeting finally drew to an end, no decisions were taken at all.
Chapter 4. Wieland House, Berlin. 17 July 1985. Victory Day.
"And where have you been all day, young lady?"
Gudrun grimaced as her mother's voice echoed out of the kitchen. She might be 18 years old and a university student, having passed the hardest set of exams in Germany, but her mother still talked to her as though she was a little girl. It just wasn't fair, particularly when her thoughts kept returning to Conrad's broken body. But she had no choice but to swallow it and stick her head into the kitchen.
"I've been with Hilda, watching the parade," she said.
Her mother was bent over the oven, cooking something that smelled heavenly, "watching the soldiers trooping by."
"You should have been here to help," her mother said, straightening up. "I don't recall saying you could leave the house."
"I'm 18, mother," Gudrun said.
When she was a mother, she was not going to keep her daughters locked in a gilded cage.
And as long as you live under my roof, you follow my rules," her mother said sternly. "I have told you many times that you are to ask before you go out, particularly this week."
Gudrun sighed as her mother turned to face her. Adelinda Wieland was tall and blonde, but her hair was slowly shading to gray after bringing up four children on a policeman's salary and what little she could claim from the government. It had often baffled Gudrun how people could compare her to her mother, although Grandpa Frank had been heard to claim that Gudrun was the spitting image of his wife. Her mother's face was very different from Gudrun's, and her hair a shade or two lighter before it started to go gray.
"I have a boyfriend, mother," she said.
She felt an odd pang at the memory. Adelinda had never really approved of Conrad, but her husband had approved the match.
"I'm not going to get into trouble."
"That's what they all say," her mother said. "A soldier in a pretty uniform, perhaps a glass or two of beer. Who knows what will happen?"
Gudrun felt her face heat. Her mother could be uncomfortably blunt at times. She still cringed at the memory, years ago, of having her mother explain where babies came from and why she should be very careful until she was actually married. There was a black market in contraception, she'd been told, but condoms and American-made pills couldn't be purchased unless the user already had 3 children. University student or not, Gudrun had no idea where she might obtain any condoms, let alone how she might convince her boyfriend to use one. Men could be such idiots at times. She shuddered. Conrad wasn't going to recover. It was unlikely, the nurse had said, that he could survive without the machine, and even if he did, he'd be unable to do anything with her. Part of her even wished she'd pulled the plug on him before leaving, even though it would probably have set off alarms. Her boyfriend deserved better than to remain a vegetable for the rest of his life.
"I'm glad you're thinking about it," her mother sneered.
It took Gudrun a moment to realize that her mother had seen the shudder and misinterpreted it.
"Go take Grandpa Frank his dinner before your father comes home. He'll want to eat as soon as he arrives."
Gudrun groaned.
"Mother, can't Johan do it?"
"Go," her mother ordered, pointing at the tray. "Now." There was no point in arguing with her mother when she was cross, Gudrun knew from bitter experience. There were 2 younger boys in the house, yet they never had to do any cooking or washing up. It didn't seem fair somehow. She picked up the tray, swallowing the curse that came to mind when she saw the bottle perched next to the covered dish, and headed for the door. She'd once dumped the beer down the sink, hoping it would make Grandpa Frank more pleasant, but her mother had been furious. Gudrun had never dared to do it again. She walked slowly up the stairs, stalling as long as she could. Grandpa Frank's room was at the far end of the corridor, forcing her to walk past the room shared by Johan and Siegfried, and her own door before she reached her grandfather's door. Johan had complained, loudly, that he hadn't been allowed to move into Kurt's room now that his elder brother spent most of his time in the barracks, but their father had flatly refused to allow him to take the empty room. Gudrun smiled at the memory. There weren't many advantages to living in a patriarchal household, but watching her brothers forced to share a room was definitely one of them.
"Come," an imperious voice bellowed.
Gudrun flinched. She'd never worked out how Grandpa Frank could tell when there was someone waiting outside his room, and pushed the door open, wrinkling her nose at the stench. As always, the room was an odd combination of orderly and disorderly. The bed looked neat and tidy, but there were beer bottles lying on the floor and the remains of a snack sitting on the bedside table. Grandpa Frank himself was sitting in an armchair, reading a newspaper and drinking from a half-full bottle of beer. Gudrun's stomach turned at the thought of helping the disgusting old man to the toilet, although, to be fair, he'd never seemed to have any problems staggering out of bed and doing his business as far as she knew.
"Victory day," Grandpa Frank said. "You must be very proud."
"Yes, Grandpa," Gudrun said.
She'd never been sure just who Grandpa Frank thought she was half the time. Half of what he said made no sense at all.
"But my boyfriend..."
Her voice caught. Grandpa Frank was... a cripple. No, not quite a cripple, but he needed a wheelchair if he wanted to leave the house. And Conrad wouldn't even have that if by some dark miracle he survived. He...
"The paratrooper," Grandpa Frank said darkly. "I heard he was planning to become a policeman. It's no place for a young man."
Wonderful, Gudrun thought. The paratrooper turned policeman was her father. He thinks I'm my mother. She eyed her grandfather carefully as she placed the tray on the table beside him. Grandpa Frank's mood changed rapidly. She'd seen him go from maudlin, mourning his long-dead wife, to angry and raging at the world within seconds. Only his daughter could talk sense into him when he was angry. Gudrun honestly didn't understand why her mother allowed the old man to stay in the house. Grandpa Frank had come alarmingly close to clobbering Johann's brains out when the younger boy had snuck up on him for a dare.
"My boyfriend didn't take part in the parade," she said flatly.
It was honest enough, to be sure.
I miss him.
Just stay faithful to him, Grandpa Frank advised. It's no service to a decent lad to trade him in when another one comes along.
Gudrun felt her cheeks heat. The idea of Grandpa Frank, of all people, giving her relationship advice was horrifically embarrassing. She honestly had no idea what he'd done in the war, but he'd had enough nightmares to make it clear that it had been something thoroughly unpleasant. Maybe he'd been in Stalingrad during the brutal house-to-house fighting, or invaded Moscow towards the end of the war. He was certainly old enough. But Mother won't let us ask him any questions, she thought. And she slapped Johann when he tried.
I'll do my best, she said.
She stepped back from the older man, never taking her eyes off him.
I hope it's good food.
Grandpa Frank ignored her as he took a long swig from the bottle and started to mutter to himself in a dialect Gudrun didn't recognize. Careful to breathe through her mouth, she looked around the room, picked up the used plates and cutlery, and headed back downstairs to the kitchen. Her mother was waiting, hands resting impatiently on her hips. Gudrun rolled her eyes as her mother pointed to the sink, then emptied the plates into the bin, put the dishes in the water, and washed them hastily. Grandpa Frank never seemed to finish a meal. Too busy drinking, Gudrun thought, as her mother started to hand out more tasks before she could make her escape, and trying to drown his sorrows. She looked at her mother, who was just taking a tray of sausages out of the oven.
Why do we keep Grandpa Frank here when we could send him to one of the veteran homes?
Her mother turned and gave her the look that generally preceded a hard slap.
When your father and I are old and gray, she said coldly, will you look after us, or will you send us to a home?
Gudrun flinched.
Of course I'll look after you. My father practically raised me since my mother died young, Adelinda said. Whatever his flaws, and he has many, he managed to raise a daughter despite never remarrying. I cannot put him into a home to die, young lady, and you're being thoroughly unpleasant to suggest it.
Yes, mother, Gudrun said, feeling tiny under her mother's gaze. I'm sorry.
And we get an extra stipend from the government for taking care of a veteran, a new voice said.
Gudrun turned to see her father standing there, wearing his policeman's uniform.
It isn't to be sniffed at, you know.
Hermann, Adelinda said tightly.
Gudrun gave her father a hug.
How was work?
Your daughter was out with a friend half the day, and your eldest son has yet to return, Adelinda said, before her father could say a word. I expect you to speak to them both after dinner.
Yes, dear, Hermann said, as he let go of Gudrun. Gudrun, speak to me after dinner.
Gudrun nodded, hoping he couldn't see the amusement on her face. She'd been taught in school that a wife was to be obedient to her husband, cook his dinners, have his children, and treat him like a king. Whoever had written the stupid textbook she'd been forced to read, she was sure, was either a man with a female pen name or a woman who'd never actually married anyone. Adelinda didn't even pretend to be obedient to her husband. The household was her realm, and God help anyone who questioned her right to rule.
There was the usual run of pickpockets and other trouble causers, her father added, picking up a biscuit from the jar while his wife's back was turned. A group of children ran riot in the square, but someone very high up ordered that they were merely to be sent back to school rather than face punishment. It was quite strange.
Poor kids, Gudrun said.
She'd been lucky to escape a full Victory Day parade while she'd been at school, but she'd had to stand for hours for smaller parades, and by the time they were finally dismissed, she'd been aching and sore.
Are they going to be all right?
Probably, her father said.
Gudrun, take the potatoes and put them on the table, her mother interrupted.
Hermann, if you're going to stand around here, take the bottles of beer and put them by the plates.
Yes, dear, her father said. Shall I give Johannes a big mug?
Probably not, Adelinda said.
She normally banned alcohol from the table, save for Grandpa Frank, but this was Victory Day.
I don't want him drinking too much and winding up being sick over my nice clean carpet.
Gudrun winced inwardly as she carried the potatoes out. Johann and Siegfried were already sitting at the table, looking as though butter wouldn't melt in their mouths. They might as well be twins, she'd often thought, although Johann was blonde while Siegfried was brown, taking more after their father. He was growing up quickly, too, she noted. He was the baby of the family at 12, but he'd already lost his childlike appearance. Like everyone else at school, he'd been forced to exercise on the playing fields until he'd shed every last trace of fat from his body.
That looks good, Johann said, eyeing the potatoes with interest. You think Mother cooked them in gravy?
Go ask her, Gudrun snapped.
Johann needed to learn, the sooner the better, that she wasn't there to answer his every whim. It was a service to his future wife.
And seeing you're just sitting there, why don't you put out the knives and forks?
Do it,
their father agreed, stepping into the room carrying a pair of bottles in one hand.
If you want to be lazy, you can go join the Luftwaffe and sit on your bottom all day.
I like flying, Johann protested. I'm going to sign up for the Luftwaffe next year.
Gudrun smiled.
You might not learn how to fly, she needled.
She'd looked up the figures when one of her fellow students had started to date a pilot.
For everyone who gets accepted for pilot training, there's three or four who get accepted for work on the ground. That's not quite as impressive.
Johann's face fell.
But I'm a natural pilot.
The Luftwaffe needs more than just pilots, their father said.
He gave Gudrun a look that sent her scurrying back into the kitchen, just as Kurt arrived, still wearing his uniform.
And if you learn how to maintain a fighter jet, Johann, you will have something to build on when you return to civilian life.
I'm going to become an astronaut, Johann said.
Gudrun could still hear him, even over the sound of sizzling sausages.
If I manage to do well as a pilot, I can put in for space training and go to the moon.
Gudrun smirked as she took the sausages and carried them back into the dining room, her mother following her with the vegetables. Johann was hardly alone in wanting to fly aircraft. A third of the boys she'd known in school had had the same ambition, but the odds were against him. And if he did manage to join the Luftwaffe without actually becoming a pilot, he'd be forever branded an REMF rather than a fighter. His chances of winning the hearts and bodies of countless girls, as he had seen on television programs, would be sharply reduced.
"This is Victory Day," her father said, once the food had been served and the beer had been poured. "Let us remember, just for a moment, how we became the most powerful nation in the world."
Now tell me, Gudrun thought, is that actually true? It wasn't a pleasant thought, but it had to be faced. The state had lied at least once, and no matter how much she tried, she couldn't think of anything that disproved her theory that Conrad wasn't the only wounded soldier to be kept away from his family. And if the state had lied once, who knew what else it had lied about? How much of what she'd been taught had been a lie? She was pretty sure they couldn't have lied about basic maths. She could prove that 2 + 2 = 4. But it was a great deal easier to lie about the social subjects. Had there really been a great war? Grandpa Frank fought in the war, she thought. He was hardly the only old man with a military background. She had several friends who had elderly relatives living with them or staying in veteran homes. So there must have been a war. But what really happened? She ate her food slowly, barely tasting the sausages and potatoes as she thought. What could she do? Conrad's family might make a fuss if she told them the truth, but it was equally possible they'd report her for sneaking into a hospital. She could keep it to herself, yet the part of her that loved Conrad wanted to do something about his case. But what? If she tried to protest herself, she'd wind up in an asylum if she was lucky.
I need to speak to you, her father said once the dinner was over.
Gudrun had been so lost in her thoughts that she hadn't noticed that the meal was coming to an end.
You too, Kurt.
Kurt gave Gudrun a sharp look as their father rose to his feet. Gudrun shrugged. Their father might know they'd slipped out of the house, but he didn't know where they'd been. As long as they stuck to the cover story,
they'd be safe, or so she hoped. If the nurse Kurt had been trying to flirt with reported their presence after he stood her up, the SS might start looking for a pair of intruders, and if they got lucky, they might catch her before she could tell anyone what they'd seen. 2 more days of parades, she thought, and then I can go back to university, and then... She sucked in her breath. Officially, the university was politically neutral. Unofficially, students talked all the time. They were, after all, among the smartest people in the Reich. Many of them had worked hard to escape conscription by passing the exams and winning a place in the university. And almost all of the students would know at least one person in the military. How many students had seen a relative go to South Africa and not return? But it wasn't something she dared discuss with Kurt. Who knew which side he'd take? Talk to the students, she told herself, as she led the way into her father's office. She had a feeling her father would just tell them both off, but there was no point in dawdling. And then, decide what to do next. Chapter 5. American Embassy, Berlin. 19 July, 1985.
Well, Ambassador Samuel Turtledove said. Thoughts?
Andrew allowed himself a smile. Ambassador Turtledove had no time for the persistent rivalry between the Office of Strategic Services, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, to say nothing of the military itself. They were, after all, right in the heart of Berlin, in the first building that would fall if war ever broke out between the North Atlantic Alliance and the Third Reich. There was literally no time for inter-service rivalry or disagreements. Everyone in the room was cleared to hear everything up to top secret and beyond.
It was an impressive show, he said, as he accepted a cup of coffee from the ambassador's aide.
I counted over 30 long-range heavy bombers in a single flypast. They certainly look as though they can reach New York.
Assuming they don't get bounced halfway there, General William Knox pointed out.
The military attaché frowned down at the photographs the observers had taken during the parade and placed on the table.
We still have fighter bases up and down the East Coast despite the best efforts of Congress. The Brits have their fighters, too.
One would assume the Brits would have other things to worry about if war broke out, Andrew said mildly. But I tend to agree. The long-range bomber isn't a major threat unless they build them in far greater numbers.
Which leads to the obvious question, the ambassador said. Can they build them in far greater numbers?
Andrew looked at Penelope Jameson, who shrugged.
The German economy is a mess, Mr. Ambassador, she said.
The CIA had attached her to the Berlin office as an expert in economics and charged her with gauging the strength of the German economy. It wasn't a task Andrew envied her.
I honestly think that most Germans are unaware of just how badly their economy is performing, certainly when compared to ours. Funding a new 100 long-range bombers would be very difficult right now.
Particularly as they would be of limited value in South Africa, Knox said.
Perhaps not, Andrew said. They can fly well above the Stinger A's range, can't they? He smiled as Knox and Robert Hamilton grimaced in unison. The OSS had been pressing the president to send Stinger B and Stinger C missiles to the South Africans, even though there was a very real risk that one or more units would fall into German hands and be reverse-engineered. He understood their concerns, but there was a very real opportunity to bleed the Germans white using the missiles. Shooting down a handful of heavy bombers would hurt the Reich more than killing a few hundred soldiers on deployment. And if war does break out, he thought, there will be fewer bombers to make their way to New York.
They're not exactly equipped for tactical support, Knox said after a moment. Their smart weapons are considerably inferior to our own.
We think, Andrew reminded him. The Gauchos probably didn't know how to use their weapons to best advantage.
They would have set up a display and shown off their merchandise if they could, Penelope said quietly. Their economy took a hit when the Falklands War went so badly for the side using German weapons.
Serve them right, the ambassador said. He cleared his throat.
Was there anything new in the parade? Any potential game changers?
Probably not, Andrew said. The latest tank design was a modified Panther 7, their main battle tank. I don't think we have to worry about a revolutionary new tank appearing on the battlefield in a few years.
They also modified a handful of older Panzer 11s, Hamilton added. It's hard to be sure, but it looks like they took off the main guns and added several machine guns to the vehicles.
Probably for counterinsurgency work, Knox grunted.
He picked up one of the photographs and held it out.
We know they've been taking losses in South Africa, Mr. Ambassador. My best guess is that they're adapting their weapons and armor to cope with the threat.
Which isn't likely to go away anytime soon, Andrew thought. The blacks know they have to fight and perhaps die, rather than doing nothing and certainly dying.
He shuddered at the thought.
The Reich's population might be blissfully unaware of what had been done in their name, but everyone else knew all too well what Adolf Hitler had unleashed upon the world. He wouldn't have bet a rusty dollar that the blacks would survive for long if the Nazis claimed the country. They'd be herded into concentration camps and brutally murdered. Indeed, there were factions in South Africa that would happily support such a final solution, heedless of the possibility that the Nazis would shove them into the gas chambers next. The ambassador cleared his throat.
Do you feel it's likely they will double down in South Africa?
Andrew hesitated.
They made a mistake getting involved, he said.
We know that, and I suspect they know it too now. But I think their leadership will be reluctant to retreat from their positions in South Africa. They'd see it as an admission of weakness.
He looked up at the map.
The Reich bestrode the continent like a colossus, bright red ink soaking the land from Dunkirk to Kamchatka. And yet, their control over their vast domains was tenuous in places. The settlements in Germany East were plagued by partisans. The Vichy French were restless, and even their allies were looking for alternatives. Andrew was sure that Turkey, at least, would jump ship if there was a reasonable chance of getting away with it, while Italy and Spain wouldn't be far behind. Binding their economies to Germany had been a deadly mistake.
Economically, they must be reaching their limits, Penelope said. All my models suggest Germany will have to make major cutbacks within the next 5 years.
Your models may not take reality into account, Knox pointed out.
He'd never liked Penelope, although Andrew had never figured out why.
Surely they know how to fine-tune their own economy.
An economy is not a military unit, sir, Penelope said. Nor is it a piece of bulky machinery that can be fixed. Fine-tuning an economy is simply impossible, and trying to control it leads to disaster. The communists discovered that in 1942.
She took a breath.
My models are, if anything, optimistic, she added. I gave the Germans every advantage I could think of, sir. I assumed a level of central understanding and control that, quite frankly, is beyond the realm of possibility, and yet all of my models indicate a major collapse in less than 5 years, unless something changes.
Andrew frowned.
They could be spoofing your results.
They could, Penelope agreed. We have always had problems gauging the true power of the German economy. However, if it was as good as they claimed, they'd have a much larger moon base and a few hundred additional spacecraft to stake their claims to the asteroids.
True, Andrew agreed.
It's also beside the point, Knox said.
Is the likelihood of war any stronger than it was 2 years ago?
Maybe that's why he doesn't like her, Andrew thought. He understands the machines and tactics of war, but not economics.
The last set of discussions I had with the foreign minister were unenlightening, the ambassador said calmly. He lodged an official complaint about our meddling in South Africa. I lodged a complaint of my own about German weapons shipments to radical factions in Latin and South America. We had a long argument that boiled down to mutual denials that anything was actually happening.
And so anyone on the ground will vanish if they get caught, Andrew said.
We do it too, Hamilton reminded him. Any German advisor caught in Panama goes straight into a black prison for interrogation, not held for trade.
Andrew nodded ruefully.
The threat of mutual destruction, Germany and the United States each had over 10,000 nuclear warheads, had made it impossible for either side to risk seeking a final war to decide the fate of the planet. Instead, Germany had started running weapons and supplies to radical groups in Latin America, while America had supplied Russian, French, and South African insurgents with weapons of their own. But German brutality made it impossible for them to end the war on anything other than total victory, while the United States could use a combination of hard and soft power to convince the undecided to support the Americans. Mexico was more peaceful than it had been in years. Panama, the scene of a brutal insurgency, was calming down. But the Germans can't afford to treat anyone as equals, he thought darkly. They have to exterminate their enemies to win, which makes it impossible for their enemies to surrender. Knox looked at Penelope sharply. What happens if the German economy does collapse?
It's hard to be sure, Penelope said. I think we'd be looking at something akin to the Great Depression, but probably a great deal worse. The German economy is more integrated than ours was in the 30s.
And then they will go to war, Knox said grimly. Hitler saw war as the solution to Germany's woes. War will distract their people from their empty bellies.
They'd have to be out of their minds, Hamilton said. We have the America Shield, do we not?
The system isn't perfect, Knox reminded him. If the Germans throw every last one of their missiles at us in a single volley, will the shield stop them all?
We'd certainly have a better chance of survival than they would, Hamilton snapped. What the bombs didn't destroy would be wiped out by their slaves afterwards.
And a full-scale nuclear war might well destroy the entire world, Penelope said. Nuclear winter will finish off the survivors.
Andrew shook his head in grim horror.
Perhaps they won't see it that way, he said. They may view mutual destruction as a victory of sorts.
The ambassador held up a hand.
What are their alternatives?
Cut their cloak to suit their cloth, Penelope said. They'll have to make massive and painful budget cuts.
Which they can't, for political reasons, Knox commented. They're committed to trying to keep up with us.
Andrew sighed inwardly. The Germans had been fearsome, and they still were, but they'd also been very good at projecting an illusion that they were stronger than they were. The CIA had yet to recover from taking some of the German claims at face value back in the 60s and terrifying Congress into authorizing a colossal military buildup. Now, it was the Germans who were struggling to stay in the race.
Assuming we're correct, he reminded himself, the buggers have got themselves caught in an elephant trap.
Maybe it would be a good time to propose limits to military spending, the ambassador said calmly. Let them off as lightly as we can.
It was tried back in the 70s, Knox said. We caught them cheating.
Back when it looked as though we would lose Mexico, Hamilton said. We face the same dilemma as the Germans are facing now. Do they cut their losses and admit defeat, or up the ante?
He shrugged. Our ability to influence their decision-making process is rather limited. I have to speak to the president, the ambassador said. Do we try to take advantage of their problems, or do we commit ourselves to doing nothing?
Unless the Germans become more reasonable, we can't really do much more than we already are, Andrew said. We cannot trust them to honor any agreement they make. They cannot take the risk of being backed into a corner. Sir, the Reich is hellishly unstable. If it goes down, it could easily go down into war.
Penelope leaned forward.
We could offer to mediate peace in South Africa.
We'd have problems finding a solution everyone involved could live with, Hamilton said darkly. The South Africans themselves will want to remain top dog in the manger for the rest of eternity, while the blacks will want, at the very least, self-rule and an end to the apartheid system. And the nasties will want to exterminate the blacks and probably add South Africa to the Third Reich. Remove the German forces and the South Africans will either have to flee the country or be brutally murdered by the blacks. Stop supplying the blacks with weapons, and the Germans will probably shove them all into gas chambers, if there are any left alive by the end of the war.
Andrew shuddered. The South African government had imposed a complete lockdown on newsmen traveling to South Africa, but a handful of intrepid reporters had made the long journey to the front. They'd sent back horrific stories and pictures, including one of hundreds of villages being firebombed from high overhead and refugees gunned down mercilessly. It had shocked America, particularly the black population. The president might find it politically impossible to stop sending weapons and supplies to the insurgents. He'd be deserted by every black congressman and senator in the country.
And if the Germans do abandon South Africa, the chaos will spread to Germany South, he added.
It might not be a bad thing. Germany South was the world's largest source of uranium, but it would definitely worry the German leadership.
And then it will spread upwards into French and Italian territory.
The Germans would be wise to consolidate what they've got, Penelope said flatly. If they try to hold on to their entire empire, they'll likely lose everything.
They seem to disagree with you, Knox said.
I'd be surprised if they truly understood the problem, Penelope said mildly. I've met a great many political and military leaders who refuse to even try to understand economics.
Ouch, Andrew thought, as Knox's face flushed with anger. A palpable hit.
The ambassador tapped the table sharply.
I'm due to speak with the president tomorrow, he said. Do I advise him, then, to do nothing and just wait for the Reich to fall apart on its own?
I suggest you advise him to take some extra precautions just in case, Knox advised. If they're planning to strike against us, they're not going to tell their own people until the rockets are in the air. Putting the air and missiles bases on alert might make the difference between survival and destruction.
They'd just be committing suicide, Penelope argued. It makes no sense.
She had a point, Andrew knew. The Reich and the NAA didn't share a border. They might be able to launch an invasion force across the English Channel, but getting the Wehrmacht to Washington, D.C. was a fool's dream. They'd have to contend with the United States Navy, the United States Air Force, the Royal Navy, and the Canadian Navy. Andrew privately doubted the Germans would get halfway across the ocean before every last one of their ships were sunk. The Germans could make America miserable. Tracking down Nazi sleeper cells was a persistent headache for the FBI. But they couldn't invade and occupy territory.
They may not realize the truth, Hamilton said. Or they might not care. Just because they look like us doesn't mean they think like us.
Andrew nodded. He'd seen what passed for education in German schools. It was long on physical exercise and quasi-military training, short on teaching boys and girls how to be anything other than interchangeable cogs in a machine. He still shuddered at visiting a school one day and watching the children mouth their hatred of non-Aryans. The only good thing about the whole affair was that the pictures they were shown of Jews were so horrifically caricatured that the children wouldn't recognize a Jew if they saw one.
See what else you can gather from your sources, the ambassador added. Maybe we can find a way to let them down gently.
They'd hate us for making the offer, Knox said.
They're already placing orders for more computers and other advanced electronics, Hamilton added. He looked at Penelope. How long can they pay for them?
Unknown, Penelope said. But the Reich's stockpile of foreign currency is quite low. I'd advise the sellers to make sure they get cash in advance.
Knox scowled.
Does that not present a threat to us?
Possibly, Andrew said before Penelope could say a word. But you try convincing the corporations that they shouldn't sell their outdated crap to the Germans. The ambassador finished his coffee and rose.
I'll see you all after I speak with the president, he said, checking his watch.
It was nearly midnight.
Until then, good night.
Andrew smiled as he departed, followed by Knox. The military attaché would have his own report to write. Andrew, thankfully, could put his off until the following morning, when he'd had a chance to think about what he'd seen. Hamilton finished his own coffee, then headed for the door himself. Andrew watched him go, then looked at Penelope. She looked tired and cross-eyed.
I plan to go for a walk in a couple of days, he said.
He wasn't asking for a date, although he knew that some people wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
Do you want to accompany me?
Penelope hesitated. Andrew understood. No real harm would come to them, they'd been warned when they accepted the posting, but the SS sometimes harassed American visitors to Berlin. It was no great secret that spies were based in the embassy, even though Andrew, Hamilton, and Penelope herself had cover stories that should explain their activities. The SS might hope that harassing the Americans would lead them to German traitors.
It might be fun, she said finally.
She understood what they'd be really doing all right. A young couple out on a stroll would attract less attention than a man on his own. Why not?
Chapter 6. Albert Speer University, Berlin. 20 July, 1985. Walking into the Albert Speer University for the first time, Gudrun recalled as she walked towards the doors had been like taking a breath of fresh air for the first time in her life. Like every other child in the Reich, she had endured 15 years of schooling where she'd been expected to regurgitate answers and otherwise do exactly as she was told. She'd quite lost count of the number of times she'd been forced to run laps around the school, stand in the corridor, or undergo other humiliating punishments for daring to actually question the teacher's words, let alone the letters they'd sent home to her parents. And yet, despite that, university had seemed a more attractive option at 17 than trying to become a nurse, a housewife, or entering one of the few careers open to women. It had been a surprise when she'd been told that the traits that had got her in trouble at school were precisely the traits the university wanted from its students.
"You have not been taught to think," her first tutor had said when he'd addressed the class on the very first day.
It had been the first mixed-sex class Gudrun had ever had, but she'd been too fascinated to notice the presence of young men mixed in with the young women.
"Here, we will attempt to teach you to think."
Her first year at the university had been fascinating, to say the least. She'd learned how to use a computer, one of the blocky American-made machines that were imported into the Reich at great expense, and dozens of other skills that made up the background for STEM courses. She knew she had to choose a major by the time she turned 20, when she would be expected to specialize in one particular field of study, but she was honestly tempted to try to delay that as long as she could. No one had shown her anything of the sort while she'd been at school, let alone allowed her to come to her own conclusions. Hell, she'd never heard of anyone being expelled from the university for asking questions. They were all too eager to learn to make trouble.
"We don't take everyone," the tutor had said a year ago. "The exams we set look for the underlying potential for intelligence, not developed intelligence. You are here because we believe we can help your minds to flourish, and in return, you will advance the Reich."
She took a moment to admire the statue of Albert Speer, architect, minister, and one of the three guiding minds of the Reich after Hitler's death, then hurried into the building. As always, it was packed. Students who had been given the week off for Victory Day had hurried back as soon as they could, preparing for the exams they knew to be coming in 3 months, exams that would determine their future. Far too many of them actually lived on campus, sharing rooms in university accommodation that were strictly segregated and chaperoned. Gudrun remembered, with a flicker of envy, how she'd begged her mother and father to allow her to apply for one of the university rooms, but her mother had flatly refused to allow Gudrun to live away from home. "Probably thought I'd spend all my time in bed with Conrad," she thought bitterly. There were house mothers, she'd been told, but they couldn't hope to chaperone everyone and abandon my studies completely if I fell pregnant. She gritted her teeth at the thought as she hurried into the lecture hall. Some of her friends were already there, pens and paper at the ready. They knew better than to be late when a lecture was about to begin. The doors would be closed a minute after the deadline, and anyone who failed to make it would be marked as absent, which would lead to a thoroughly unpleasant discussion with the dean. Gudrun had never faced the man himself, thankfully, but she'd heard rumors that anyone who missed more than 2 classes in a row was given a punishment so awful that no one ever spoke of it. Which raises the question of just how people know that something happens, she thought,
dryly. The dean probably started the rumors himself, just to keep us in line. She took her seat and nudged Hilda Morgenstern, a dark-haired girl who'd been her friend ever since the first week at university.
"Meeting in the private study room this afternoon after lunch," she hissed. "Pass it on."
Hilda gave her a sharp look. Their private study group wasn't exactly a formal organization, and then nodded, turning to whisper in Sven's ear. Gudrun hadn't been entirely sure that a group composed of both males and females could work. The handful of dances she'd endured at school had been marred by male behavior as they grew older, but she had to admit that Sven and the others were very focused on their work. Sven, in particular, was going to be a computer designer, or so he'd said. He already had an uncanny insight into how the computers they used at university actually worked.
"I think that's everyone told," Hilda muttered, once the whispered message had gone down the row. "Isn't it a little early to be panicking over exams?"
"It's not about the exams," Gudrun muttered back.
The tutor closed the doors with a loud thud and strode to the podium, his dark eyes searching for troublemakers.
"I'll tell you this afternoon."
The lecture would have been interesting, she had to admit, if she hadn't been thinking about Conrad and everything she'd deduced. Thankfully, the tutor didn't call on her to answer questions. She'd barely heard half of what he'd said, and by the time the class finally came to an end, she'd reluctantly struck a deal with Hilda for a copy of her notes. She'd have to work extra hard, if she could muster the energy, to catch up. The tutors rarely showed any sympathy to anyone who attended the lectures and still needed to beg for advice and assistance.
"That's not like you," Hilda observed as they headed for lunch. "Are you all right?"
"I'll tell you in the study room," Gudrun said.
She caught Leopold's arm as he passed.
"Can you bring your stereo?"
Leopold blinked in surprise.
"Of course I can," he said. "I'll see you after lunch."
Hilda stuck with Gudrun all through lunch, but had the common sense to keep her questions under wraps while they joined the line for food and drink, then ate as quickly as they could at a small table. The refectory was crammed with students, some wearing uniforms from the nearby military college, others daringly wearing American jeans and T-shirts that had been either smuggled into the Reich or sold at an enormous markup in one of the few American stores in the city. Gudrun winced inwardly as she saw one girl swaying past, her jeans so tight around her buttocks that she thought they were going to split open at any moment, then followed Hilda up the stairs and into the study room. Leopold was already there, attaching his stereo to the socket.
"So," he said as he turned on the machine, "what's all this about then?"
"Wait and see," Gudrun said.
She sat down and waited as the remainder of the study group, five girls, seven boys, entered the room, then waved to Hilda to close and lock the door. Conrad, the one time he'd visited, had shown her where the bug was hidden, within the spare power socket. She motioned for Leopold to put the stereo next to the bug, then tapped the table for attention. Conrad might never recover from his wounds, but at least he would have a little revenge. She hesitated, knowing that a single traitor within the group would spell her death, then took the plunge.
"This isn't about our studies," she said. It's political. If any of you are uneasy, please leave now, and we won't mention it to you again."
There was a long pause. No one left. Gudrun shuddered inwardly. No one said anything overtly, but everyone knew that the SS had eyes and ears everywhere. Anyone could be a spy. Anyone. Children were induced to betray their parents if they said something against the Reich. Wives could be convinced that their duties to the Reich were more important than their duties to their husbands. The university might be a lair for free thinkers. It might have been designed to allow young Germans to think. But that only meant the SS would have more invested in keeping an eye on it. Hell, the only reason she believed Conrad had been a genuine visitor to the university the first time they'd met was that he'd worn his uniform. "And I will not let him down," she thought savagely. There were some risks that had to be taken, even if the consequences were severe. She was damned if she was letting them get away with crippling her boyfriend and then lying to his family. I will do whatever it takes to take revenge. As you know,